Accession number 30623, reel 10.
Accession number 30623, Ray O'Leary, reel 10. Now, so what happened next? You've gone up to Cap Yong, then you come back to Ujongbu.
Yeah.
Now, what was a typical day like at Ujongbu? I mean, what were you actually doing? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, we didn't seem to be doing anything. I can't recall doing anything, honestly. I just can't recall it. All I know that we were under, it was wooden building, and it was warm than outside, and that was about all I can remember of it. But what we were actually engaged in there, I can't recall. I can't imagine a lot of route marches with a pipe band. I recall doing that, but that's about all I can recall doing. Just keeping you mobile.
But you weren't under attack?
No.
Except by this one time was by the Americans.
That was only a 10-minute sort of a. Yeah.
Now the next thing, 28th of November, you moved to
Pyongyang.
Pyongyang, that's the capital of North Korea, I think.
It is. Yeah, we were being trained in cattle trucks. I think it's 180 mile. And freezing cold, it was cold, and we were in unheated cattle trucks, and we moved up to detrained at Pyongyang. The 8th Hussars came up, they'd gone up, I think they started before us. Whether they went on low loaders, I'm not sure, but they joined us in Pyongyang.
And what was the situation, as far as you were aware? You may not have known. I mean,
yeah. I didn't know. All we knew was that it was all a question of buzzes, rumours that were. It were not rumours. Well, yeah, rumours, I suppose, that you listen to, that the Americans and MacArthur, who was in control there, had decided that when he got up to the Yalu River, had decided that he wanted to go into China and get rid of these commies for good. And there was a lot of problem, and we were then told that we were going a couple more, as local defence for Centurion tanks. So we embossed onto the tanks at the back. They had Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, if I recall, and it was lovely and warm at the back of the tank. So we used to sit on the back of the tank, and we went up about 16 mile north of the North Korean capital.
And this is an 8th King's...
8th Royal Irish Hussars. The 8th King's Royal Irish Hussars. Yeah. They were... And these tanks were ultra-mod because they had what they called the gun stabilising gear. I think the first ones... In fact, I'm pretty sure the first ones to be fitted were the gun stayed on the target, whether the tank undulated at all, the barrel of the gun stayed steady, and it was called gun stabilizer.
What did you think generally of the Centurion? It was an impressive tank.
Yeah, I mean, it was I think it went about 80 ton. I think it was quite a big tank, big heavy tank. Yeah.
And how did you get on with the tank crew?
Quite well. They had, fortunately, they had a heater, a ring inside, and would, when opportunity arose, pardon me, would brew up and give us a brew of tea. So,
Now, you were, so how far north, you're 16 miles north of the capital.
That's where there were four Centurion tanks and us, my four sections.
Oh, so it wasn't just one Centurion?
Oh, no, it was a troop, four. Four Centurion tanks.
So,
and they were astride the MSR, which is the main supply route, And they would, during the day, they were static, but during the day would, beg your pardon, they would go astride the MSR facing north, two at the front and two at the stern. And this MSR was elevated, it had grass bank each side. So when the tanks went there, then we dug in front of them in trenches.
So you were going on, you're telling me about the defensive arrangements around the main supply route.
Yes, this tank, yeah. And of course, by that time, the what it was called by the British, the Great Bug Out arrived, where the Chinese came over the border into North Korea. And so the Americans started a big withdrawal.
And when was that? Was that the last day of... You've got a note, it's the last day of 1950, so...
December.
Yeah,
yeah, it would be. It would be about the last week of December.
Now, what... That sounds better. Yeah. Now, what impact did that have on you? You're a bit isolated up there, aren't you?
Yeah, and we were called back. And what happened was that the tanks, what they called, leaguered up at night. And that would mean that the four tanks would come and all get together. The technical term, I think it was called leaguering up. And then we had pre-dug positions around them.
So every night, as you were falling back?
No, we hadn't started falling back then. This is why
you were in a lager, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the tanks, which wasn't the tank I was on, but one of the tanks was driven by a sergeant. And he had to come up a slope across the MSR and down the slope on the other side. When he got to the roadway, having come up the slope across the road, he started to come down sideways down the slope. And he slipped a track. One of his tracks come off. One of the Caterpillar tracks. And we learnt this, you know, after. I mean, I wasn't technically minded about tanks. He slammed it in reverse like you would on a bicycle chain to run it back, to get it back on. Unfortunately, it was too far gone and it smashed the drive sprocket. And now the tank was completely immobilised. And it hadn't fired a shot in anger. This was the first Centurion tank lost in Korea. The Bow Wow, the base ordnance warrant officer from Rimi, he came up in a jeep. Someone must have radioed him. He came up and they were looking for a tank transporter to try and get it back. But I did hear him say, because he was speaking to these the officers, other tank officer, that all the low loaders were out because a lot of American tanks had slipped tracks and they were assisting them in getting their tanks back. And so there wasn't a low loader to take it back, and the only thing to do was to destroy the tank.
Because you were retreating, you couldn't
leave
it.
Well, we were about to retreat because the order, while this had happened, came in that we had to be back over the river in Pyongyang, because the bridge was going to be blown at, I think it was 0300 hours or something. So we had to be back across there, and we couldn't move it, so it had to be destroyed.
Now, how did you destroy it? Well, they're not that easy to destroy.
No, well, what we was ordered to do was to pour jerry cans of petrol, which that tank had and other tanks had, in addition to the, you know, the tanks of they had of petrol. They also had jerry cans, and we were ordered to pour, and my men were doing it, pouring petrol in through the cupola or cupola or whatever you call it, a turret, down into the tank. We put, well, a number of jerry cans. I can't recall the number, but quite a few. I know my chaps were getting a bit annoyed because they thought that you know, that a spark on there could cause a bit of an uproar. But anyway, we did the job. And then the net, camouflage nets that they had, quite large, covered the tank. We used that. I mean, this wasn't Meyer. This was an officer explaining, tell us what he wanted done. And we used that as a fuse. We put that into the tank, spread it out along rather like a, rolled up like a fuse, doused that in petrol. The other tanks were then on the MSL ready to move off. And just prior to moving off, one of the officers fired a Vary pistol at the end of the net. And the whole tank started burning, you know. And we moved off. They didn't fire any.
Was it quite an impressive sight going up?
It was, yeah. It was impressive, but they never fired any rounds into it, and I couldn't understand. You know, being only a layman, I thought the ideal thing would be to fire a few rounds when you got, you know, 500 yards away because it was illuminated. But they never. In the event. We learnt that the next day a plane, rocket firing plane, went over because it hadn't entirely done the job, and they rocketed it to finish it off. By that time we were well on our way back.
Now, you were retreating. There were people between you and the Chinese, though, weren't there?
Yes, there was Marines at... what was that?
Doesn't it?
Well, they, a lot of frostbite, you know, because the weather conditions deteriorated.
So, did you get back to this bridge in time? Tell me about that.
Yeah, we got back.
That's across the which river?
That's a good question. The river in Pyongyang. I can't recall the name of it either.
Right. I think that's okay. I can't see where it is, but
it's the river that runs through. Pyongyang, you know.
Did you make it in time then?
Oh yes, yeah. We got back in time.
And what did you do?
We were riding on the other three tanks. You know, we split my section up and put them on the other three tanks.
Like, yeah. It looks like Taidong River.
Is it Taidong? Yeah, probably is. Taidong. I think Taidong. Yeah.
Stay at where did you stay at?
No, no. We were. It was a headlong flight. Everybody, Americans on the East Coast and the West Coast and those in the middle and the British, because the 27th Brigade, British Brigade, which comprised the Argyll and Southern Highlanders and the Middlesex Regiment, they had been further up with the Americans, further near the Yalu River, which separates the North Korea from China. And where the Chinese have their, a lot, I understand, of their electricity generating plants. And so they pass through us, the Argyles. And there was lots of, the Americans were just abandoning everything. I mean, our quartermaster sergeants were given an order or told that if they wanted to, they took 1,500 weight trucks down to some store that was in Pyongyang, they could have as much cigarettes and chewing gum as they liked, and they came back loaded with cartons of cigarettes and boxes of chewing gum. And I did speak to one, and he told me that there were lots of army issue watches, and he asked if it was when he saw them and what they were doing. Asked if he could, you know, take a few of those, and they were told no, they're not to be touched. And what the chap was doing, he had a big steel plate and a hammer, and was just picking them up and smashing them with a hammer. And in the square, the main square, which I've seen since on television, where they hold the big parades, that was stacked high with ammunition, which was going to be blown. We passed by it, and God, it was must have been, I don't know, 20, 25 feet high of boxes of ammunition and stores. Another thing we saw was at the railway station, a lot of ambulances, American ambulances, new, had been bought up on train low loaders, and there was no trains to take them back. And obviously, they were all on their way out with as much gear as they could put on. And I saw Americans cutting the chassis of these tanks with acetylene cutters. Although, you know, I mean, it looked terrible to see the fact that they were just cutting them in half, apparently.
Well, where were you going back to then?
We didn't know exactly where, but as far away from the Chinese as as we could get, because they were chasing us, you know. I mean, we didn't physically see them. They must have been about 20 miles behind us, I suppose. But just getting back, everybody was just one headlong flight. It was, you know, pathetic, really. But that was the whole United Nations front seemed to collapse. Or either that, or they feared that the Chinese, they knew they were coming over in force. And then,
so what happens next then?
We're coming back. And when we got, we stopped for, everybody, you know, I mean, it's like on a motorway, you suddenly get one of these stops and you can't understand why you've stopped. And then when you get there's nothing there, it's all clear. But you did get that occasionally. I suppose it was people joining the crowd from other side roads or routes.
So it's very crowded.
Oh, it was crowded, yeah. And anyway, it then started a severe snowstorm. It was really, really cold. And these Mark I tanks, and I've been since to the museum at, I think it's Boddington, is it? Or Bovington, where the tank museum is. And I took my son there, actually, and I have a photograph. And they had one of these, I think they Mark I tanks, and they had no headlights. Subsequently, headlights were fitted to the tanks, but this one had none. And this cornet, as they were called, that was their rank, the lieutenants and the North Irish horse,
King's Irish.
He asked me, because, if, you know, visibility was almost zero, and we were at the back, all crouched over the engine of this of the tank.
On the back of it, not inside it.
No, not inside it. No, on the back, and it was, you know, quite warm there. Well, I mean, as warm as warmer than it was being out on the road. And he said that the driver was having difficulty at one of these halts. Would I consider, it sounds absolutely crackers. Would I consider sitting on the front of the tank holding the spotlight if he wrapped me up in it was a very heavy tarpaulin. And what they did was, or he and another, they put me in this thing, wrapped this round me, and I was sitting on the left-hand side of the tank, just inboard of the tank track cover, holding a spotlight, and absolutely freezing. I can't imagine why he asked me to do it or why I did it. No one ever mentioned it again. I never mentioned it. It just struck me as, you know, the thing to do. If he couldn't see, God knows how the other tanks got on, I don't know. But on this tank, I was sitting there holding a spotlight, driving snow, freezing bloody cold. He gave me an extra, great coat to put on, and gloves, and pulled a balaclava, which we used to wear, down over me. And I was sitting there, and I do recall that when the time came to get off, I think they must have been about the tank, about 6 foot off the deck, I think. And I know I jumped off, and my legs just gave way, and I fell on the floor. I just collapsed on the floor. I recall that. My legs were absolutely frozen. But anyway, that wore off. We got warmed up again, and then we were put in the position on a vast plain. I can't recall where it was.
Is this in the Imjin River area? Or?
Forward of the Imjin. Yeah, a platoon was holding the ground normally held by a company. the company was holding the ground, normally held, because they were so thin on the ground, everybody had gone. Like, you know, they were, everybody, well, I say everybody, but a lot of the troops, especially the Americans, just seemed to collapse. They just went. And so we were dug in there for not long, but a few days. Never saw any action. Never, you know, just dug in a vast area that with too few troops. Then we went from there because the Chinese then were getting closer, and they moved us over the Injim on the south side. I'm pretty sure it was on the south side in Injim, where we had our first contact. And we were dug in then as a battalion on the defensive positions in the hills, low hills. Again, the name escapes me of the actual area, but I took out a patrol on the
3rd of January.
January, yeah.
Now tell me about that patrol, because that looks quite...
Well, that was I was taken out in daylight to the platoon in front of ours, because we were dug in depth. So you had one platoon in front of you on a hill. Then there was a ravine behind them, and then two platoons to the rear of those. I'm just talking about our company now, because obviously the battalion was stretched out, and you had support company and mortars, and which I never got to. But anyway, but I'm just speaking of our company, because you only knew your own area, like. And I was taken to our front platoon, looked down, and there was a small river, which would have been a river, except it was iced over and snowing. And I was told that I was to take a section about 600 yards down this river. And
the Injim?
No, it wasn't Injim. No, it was a tributary. Yeah. And make contact with Americans who were... on our left flank.
That's the 2nd Battalion, 35th US.
That's correct, yeah. And in the event, that night, I then...
It was a night patrol?
It was a night patrol, yeah. I left, I think it was...
Now, what briefing would you get?
Well, not as much... You know, on reflection, I didn't see... I certainly didn't have a radio set. I never had flare pistol, which I thought would be necessary in case I got in. I was just had these riflemen in their winter clothing, or what winter clothing there was, with these still had these wind cheaters things, which I say were absolutely useless because it was cold, wet, and I just took the patrol down and. Waited. There was a small bridge over the river, and I was told to wait there, and the American patrol would meet me, and I was to make contact with them, and then come back and report that I had contacted them. In the event, I got there, and no Americans arrived, and I was told that I was to make contact and return. When I got there, I would have thought I would have met them, exchanged words with them, and then come back. But in the event, they never arrived, and I waited an extra 10 minutes, which I shouldn't have done, and brought the patrol back, and I reported that I had made contact. I reported back to my company headquarters. I know that the diary, war diary, says that it was reported back by the patrol that all was quiet. Well, I never said it was always quiet. I just said I hadn't met anybody. And I understand that about 3 hours later, an American officer appeared at the battalion headquarters and said that they had made contact or been attacked by Chinese, and they had pulled out. And that's probably why... I never made contact with them because they weren't there. But that's an assumption. But and then another patrol went out by one of the platoon officer in the platoon in front of ours. They sent out a patrol. He had a wireless set, and he went out at, I think it was about 3 in the morning.
That on the 4th, next day.
Yeah, on the morning of the 4th, at 4 in the morning. And he went down the hill and was captured. The Chinese were waiting at the bottom of the hill in front of his platoon position, which was about 250, 300 yards. He went down there, and we heard lots of shooting, and then the word came back that he had, because it was dark, obviously, that he and the patrol had been captured. And then the Chinese started to come up the hill.
Now, what were your defensive positions like before we go on to what happened?
Oh, we just slit trenches. You know, we were
deep?
We were well dug in. Well dug in. Certainly, from your feet up to just below shoulder high. Yeah.
So about what, 4 or 5 foot?
About 4 foot, I should say, 4.5 feet. Yeah.
And how long wide? They weren't continuous trenches, were
oh,
they?
Oh no. Just they were
two mantlets.
Yeah, two men. Yeah, I had my lance corporal, who I still speak to in Ulster, and the Bren gun. He was on the Bren gun, and then each two riflemen in each. But of course, the trouble was there was a permafrost, so they were very, very difficult to get into, to dig. But we had plenty of time to prepare, so we did get down digging them. But the trouble with the permafrost was that once your bodies got in there, the heat from your bodies then turned it to water, and so the bottom of the trench was dampish. Some chaps had the foresight to grab the stalks off of, if they could get them, from rice fields, and line the bottom of the trench with those.
Now, what happened in the Chinese attack on the 4th then?
Well, when they attacked, as I say, there was a reverse slope in front of us because the platoon was on the top, or on the forward slope of the hill in front, and I heard... We heard, obviously, lots of shooting and bugles and all that rubbish, but couldn't see anything because it was dark. But I heard people scrambling down the reverse slope, which was in front of ours. And not unnaturally, I thought they were... I've lost sleepless nights over this. I assumed they were Chinese, and I was just going to give the order for the Bren gun fire to open up, my Bren gunner. And then I heard a bloke swearing in English about the fucking so-and-so, you know, bad language. And I realised what they were. They were the remainder of the platoon that had been overrun, and they were coming down the forward slope in front of our positions. And, God, I've often thought, what state I would have been in now if I had opened fire, because obviously no one was there to give the order to open fire. You know, it was down to you to do things yourself. We had a platoon sergeant, but he wasn't with us. He was in platoon headquarters along with a platoon officer who was also in platoon headquarters, dug in, you know, round the corner somewhere.
So these chaps came through you, the retreating ones. So
well, yeah, they came down into the valley in front of us, and then obviously they knew where battalion headquarters was because it was to our left, down this ravine, away from the action, and that was where the battalion headquarters were, with the 4-inch mortars by the Royal Artillery was there, and our 3-inch mortars and Vickers machine guns. And then gradually the light came up, daylight came up, and then you could really see what was going on. You could see the Chinese on top of the hill in front. And then along this ravine to our right, in front of our position, came Chinese troops led by one guy.